The FlightBridge Ed Air and Surface Transport Symposium is back, May 18th through 20th of 2020. Join us in Murfreesboro, Tennessee for our third installment of one of the best EMS conferences in the nation. Guys, I gotta tell you, get to the FlightBridgeEd.com website, click on the Fast 20 button, check out all of the pre-conference offerings. We have more than ever this year. Our speaker lineup is going to be incredible. If you've been to Fast 18, to Fast 19, you do not want to miss Fast 20. Go to FlightBridgeEd.com, click on Fast 20, get your tickets now. We'll see you in Murfreesboro.
Howdy, y'all. This is Dr. Jeff Jarvis. I have another hot-off-the-presses paper I want to talk with y'all about. Y'all remember back in episode 12 where we reviewed the Beck paper about dual sequential defibrillation? No? I'm shocked. Get it? Shocked? I swear, sometimes I think you people have no sense of humor. So for those poor souls who either didn't listen to episode 12, and shame on you, by the way, or who can't remember, we reviewed a retrospective observational study out of the Houston Fire Department looking at patients in refractory VFib who got either standard defib or dual sequence shocks. The punchline was worse survival with dual sequence. But, this is a big but, there were some serious methodology issues due to the retrospective nature of the study. Cases were not matched. Obviously, there was no randomization. And the biggest limitation is that the decision to use either single defib or dual sequence defib was at the discretion of online medical control and was made relatively late in the code. We just don't know how the patients getting standard defib differed from those getting dual sequence defib. Now, my takeaway at the time was I didn't know what to do with the results. I was getting a little bit worried about my practice and my systems using dual sequence because there had been this trial and another observational study by Mapp and his colleagues, including my friends David Wampler and Craig Manifold out of San Antonio, that showed no improvement with dual sequence. At the end of that pod, I mentioned an RCT was in progress and we expected some preliminary results in early 2020. Well, guess what? It's early 2020 and we have some interesting preliminary results. I got to give a shout out to my colleague at Williamson County EMS, John Gonzalez. He alerted me to this paper. Now, while I was eagerly awaiting it, he found it first. Strong work, John. Thanks a lot. Want to know what they found? Well, you're just going to have to hold your horses there, cowboy. We have an important message from our friend Ginger.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Welcome back, y'all. Let's dive right in, shall we? The paper is titled Double Sequential External Defibrillation for Refractory Ventricular Fibrillation, the DOSE VF Pilot Randomized Controlled Trial. It was published online in Resuscitation just a few days ago. It's by Dr. Sheldon Chessex and his colleagues at Sunnybrook in Toronto, Canada. As the name implies, this paper reports on the pilot phase of an ongoing RCT. Now, I want to emphasize the pilot part of pilot. That's important. That means these results are only preliminary and should not in any way, shape, or form be used to justify a change in practice. Now, don't go doing that after I told you not to. The results you're going to take away from this podcast, because I know you're only human after all, are not in any way ready for prime time. All right, so why publish them at all then? Well, because the primary purpose of this study was to determine the feasibility of the study protocol and the analysis plan. That's an important step in an RCT because it allows you to take a predetermined timeout early in the study and evaluate how things are going. Because it's done early in the study, problems can still be corrected. As a matter of fact, they found an issue with this pilot that they corrected for the full study. Now, it also gives you an opportunity to bail out of the full trial if the preliminary results are so lopsided that further study is both pointless and unethical. Well, how could prelim results make conducting the rest of the trial unethical? Well, I'm glad you ask. Let's say, just surely for the sake of argument, that this paper found survival in the dual sequence arm was clearly better than standard DFib. Or maybe the other way around. The trial would then be subjecting patients to an intervention that was clearly inferior, and that's unethical, especially in the design of a study using exception from informed consent, because in this case, patients don't have the opportunity to opt out of the study. All right, so let's take a look at the PICO question. And for those who may have missed some prior episodes where we talk about what PICO is, it's an acronym used to describe the key parts of a study design: the population, the intervention, the control, and the outcomes. So the population. This trial is being done in four EMS systems in rural and urban Ontario, Canada. For those familiar with the area, those services are Peel Regional Paramedic Service, Halton Region Paramedic Service, Simcoe Paramedic Service, and Toronto Paramedic Services. My apologies if I massacred the name of your system. I'm reasonably sure, as a good Rush fan, that I nailed Toronto. So these agencies combined serve a population just under 5 million, and they treat over 4,000 cardiac arrests a year. Now, by nature of the interventions being evaluated, these were patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest who presented with an initial rhythm of VFib. They included all adult patients 18 or older with a presumed cardiac etiology who were still in VFib after three manual shocks using an anterior lateral pad placement. They excluded traumatic arrest and those caused by drowning, electrocution, hanging, or drug overdose. Now, importantly, they also excluded defibrillation by bystanders or first responders in their definition of refractory VFib. So they needed three manual shocks by EMS, and if they had been shocked five times before by bystanders, that would not count in the three shocks that were needed. Now, they also excluded patients with pulseless ventricular tachycardia. And that is an interesting choice. I'm not quite sure I understand it. Maybe there's a good reason. The intervention and control. So following standard AHA-ACLS, including high-quality CPR confirmed by monitor files, and at least three standard manual defibrillation, again, remember, first responder shocks did not count, once that happened, patients were allocated to one of three arms: standard defib, vector change defib, or dual sequential defib. Initial shocks were performed between consecutive two-minute cycles of compressions with either the Zoll-X series using 120, 150, and 200 joules, or the LIFEPAK 15 using 200, 300, 360 joules. All subsequent shocks, regardless of the study arm, were done either at 200 with the Zoll or 360 with the LIFEPAK. There were two intervention arms, and those were the vector change and dual sequence. The vector change group had pad position change from the anterior to lateral. They moved the pads to the anterior-posterior position. And they do mention that they spent a lot of time training on how to do that where it had only minimal interruptions in quality. I am interested in seeing what impact they saw with that. We know how they did it. They looked with the monitor files, but I'm interested to see how minimal they could keep that interruption. Anyway, the vector change group, they went from anterior lateral to anterior posterior, and all subsequent shocks were done with this placement. The dual sequence arm had a second set of pads placed in the anterior posterior position and then attached to a second defib unit. Subsequent shocks were performed with both defibrillators. So they're going AP and anterior lateral. Now, in an attempt to avoid damaging the monitors, as has been reported in very, very small case studies and wildly reported on social media and at conferences, to avoid that potential thing, a single paramedic fired both defibs with a small delay in between to avoid simultaneous defibrillation and presumably to make sure that their warranties weren't voided. Now, standard therapy was used for the control arm. These patients continued to receive shocks every consecutive two-minute rhythm check using pads in the anterior lateral position. The randomization for this trial was done in clusters by agency, and then they would cross over. Each treatment period is going to be 6 months, and all agencies are going to complete all three arms. In this pilot phase, though, they didn't include all three periods in all three agencies. So there was one agency, and that was Toronto, that didn't include the standard therapy arm, and therefore the standard therapy group in this analysis is going to be smaller. So the primary outcome in this pilot feasibility study was the proportion of enrolled patients who received their allocated intervention, meaning standard, dual sequence, or vector change. Their target for feasibility was 80%. A secondary outcome was the proportion of enrolled patients who got their allocated intervention by the sixth shock, and their target was, again, 80%. Now, they also looked at patient safety, primarily chest burns, equipment damage, the dreaded shock-to-monitor syndrome, and they tried to get concerns from paramedics, ED staff, patients, or family. Now, they did report rates of VFib termination and ROSC in all arms, and they also looked at CPR quality as determined by a review of the monitor files. It's important to note that they performed only descriptive analysis on this data. They didn't look for statistical significance at all. They didn't put it into a model. They didn't draw any conclusions from this, and that's because that wasn't the purpose of this phase of the trial. They were looking only for feasibility. All right, so what'd they find? The pilot phase ran between March of 18 and September of 19, and they got 152 patients enrolled in the trial. Now, if you're wondering how agencies who treat over 4,000 arrests a year could have enrolled so few patients in a year and a half, remember patients had to be in VF on arrival and stay in VFib for at least three EMS-delivered shocks. Most arrests are not going to meet this criteria. In addition, they had to be cardiac etiology. So that is a small subset of all arrest. Now, the three groups were fairly well matched, which indicates that the randomization strategy worked. The big difference there was that the standard therapy had fewer patients in this phase, as we expected, because, again, the Toronto group didn't have a standard therapy group, and that's just because that wasn't the point of this trial. So overall, 89.5% of patients received their allocated intervention, and 93% of patients got that allocated intervention by the sixth shock. Both of these met their feasibility targets of 80%, and they're going to continue the study. So that's really good news. They had pretty good compliance, actually. 77% of patients got the intended intervention on the first shock at the earliest time they could. Now, they did determine that they needed to change the trial just a little bit, and they're going to include shocks delivered by first responders in their definition of what refractory VFib is. Now, they're going to do that going forward, but they will include the data from this pilot phase in the full trial. Now, the good news here is there was no equipment damage. Calm down, you vendor lawyers. Perhaps you should have listened to your engineers who were insulted by the thought. And most importantly, there was no patient harm. All right, enough about the feasibility part. Let's get to the results that y'all want. First, remember, again, you should not do anything with these results for all of the reasons I've already mentioned several times. Now, that caveat's out of the way, what did they find? Well, VF was terminated in 67% of cases in the standard group versus 82% in the vector change group and 76% in the dual sequence. Now remember, VF termination doesn't mean you get good pulses back, doesn't mean you get nice pretty P waves, it just means it ain't in VFib anymore. So standard group 67, vector change 82, and DSD 76. ROSC was achieved in 25% of the standard, 39% of the vector change, and 40% of the dual sequence. And the last thing they looked at was sustained ROSC upon ED arrival. That was present in 19 of the standard group, 25 of the vector change group, and 33 in the dual sequence group. Now, I realize it's kind of easy to get lost in the details when talking about papers like this, so let's go back to what their bottom line is. This is a feasibility study, and they have determined this is a study that's feasible, so they're going to keep going for it. Most patients got the intervention they were allocated to, and the cluster randomization appears to work. Very, 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 very prelim data shows that both dual sequence and vector change defib work better, seem to work better, let me put some other caveats in there, seem to work better than standard defib, both at getting ROSC at any time and sustaining ROSC. In other words, this is some pretty promising work. Now let's try to be patient while they run the full trial. Now, I realize that sucks. I don't do patient any better than you do, but we don't really have much of a choice. So what's my takeaway? Well, my systems currently use dual sequential defibrillation as soon as the second machine is available and they've gotten one single shock in. Now, I think the sooner the better. So that's one of the things that I like in this trial. Most of those observational trials did not even begin to look at dual sequence until the eighth or ninth shock, way into the code. I think that's too long. So I'm excited to see what they're doing. So we use dual sequence, and I will readily admit there isn't great evidence to support it. And to be honest, I was actually thinking about getting rid of it based on the observational data that was out there. Then I saw this trial was underway and decided I needed to wait. After reading this paper, I don't see any reason to change that waiting course. Making a change in something we've been doing for a while takes time to train on, and training takes money. The last thing I'd want to see happen is that we take away dual sequence only to have the one good RCT out there come back showing better survival, and then we'd have to go back to dual sequence. So we're going to hold on what we got. If the full trial comes back showing either no improvement or obviously worse outcomes, then we're going to pull it and we'll stop. And that's it for another episode. I'm recording this right now at EMS Today in Tampa. I'm in my hotel room and I'm trying out a trick that I learned from NPR. I am sitting at the hotel room desk buried in a pillow fort. It's kind of cool. I wrapped a bunch of pillows around and draped a towel over my head so that I could get a better sound. Hopefully, this is going to work. Now, the weather here in Tampa is about what you'd expect. It's pretty damn nice. It is March, after all. If we were here in August, that would be a different thing. I'm looking forward to another great EMS Today conference. I'm going to be doing a couple of talks on best research of the year and common but deadly complaints. This really should be fun. Now, as always, if you like what you hear on this podcast, please give us a good rating wherever you get your podcast. If you have questions, comments, concerns, criticisms, we'd love to hear them. You can reach us on Twitter. Mike is at Mike Verkest, and I'm at Dr. Jeff Jarvis. Stay healthy and free of the coronavirus. Take care, y'all.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.